1 John 2, verses 28 into chapter 3 and verse 3, just these three few little verses in this section of 1 John tonight. It was in the news last weekend, so even if you've got no interest in boxing at all, you probably know there was a big boxing match on last week because everyone was talking about it on the news. You couldn't help but know about it. So in the seventh round, Deontay Wilder was battered and bruised and bleeding, fighting Tyson Fury, the British challenger. And you know what his assistant trainer for Deontay Wilder, do you know what he did? What did he throw into the ring? He threw the towel into the ring. There's pictures of the towel going in. And we know what that means in boxing, don't we? When you throw the towel in, what does it mean? We give up. We concede. I lose. I give in. The fight is over. And that's where we get that phrase, throwing in the towel, from. Do you know there are times when Christians can feel like they want to throw in the towel? At times when temptation just feels so great, you think, I don't know how much more I can withstand of this temptation to sin. At times when we just feel so weary. At times when we've got great struggles as a Christian and nothing seems to be changing. I think we've talked about this before in 1 John. The Christians John's writing to are feeling that sense of weariness. So last week we looked at these antichrists and we said the antichrists were amongst them. They were in their own church. That's going to knock a congregation for six, isn't it? Yeah, to think that some of your own people, that they're antichrists, they're false teachers, that's going to be seriously emotionally draining for some of them. And they've lost their joy, their sense of assurance and confidence. So what do you do when someone's confidence is battered and people just feeling bruised and maybe even ready to throw in the towel? What do you do? Well, John does what I found myself doing in the last few weeks every Saturday morning. We've been going to Park Run over at Park Penachter, and we've been going with the boys. And you know, I've done every week with one or the other of them. One of them, partway through, says, I can't go on. I'm too tired. I can't. Please let me stop. Please. And I say to them, no, don't give up now. You can do this. I know you can do it. Stick with me and you'll be fine. And sometimes we hold hands a bit as we carry on running, but we keep on going, and every time we have got over the line. John's doing something quite similar here. He gives a command in verse 28. Now, little children, abide in him. Or if you've got an NIV, it says, remain in him. He said the same thing back in verse 24. He uses that same word, abide, several times. But really, you could just translate it. Now, there's more to it than this, but one thing he's saying there in that phrase, abide in him, is keep on going. Keep on looking to him. Stick with him and you will get there. Stick with him. Now, we read John chapter 15. And I'm sure that John is thinking back to that incident in the Lord Jesus' life when he speaks. He uses this picture of the vine. He's saying to his disciples, I'm the vine, you're the branches. And this isn't a picture of something that's really unnatural. You know how people can have, people have, say, a war injury, and then they get a metallic leg that's attached to them. It's really unnatural, isn't it? It's not a part of their body. Jesus' analogy, it isn't something unnatural in that sense. There's a unity between vine and branches. Life flows between the vine and the branches. Nutrients pass between the two. Every branch depends wholly on the vine for its life, for its energy. There's something organic and natural about this. every branch can't produce any fruit at all without it. That's the context in which Jesus said to his disciples, abide in me. And in John 15, he says it again and again. He says it in verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, verse 9, verse 10. Abide in me, cling to me, stick with me, keep on going, and you will make it to the end of the race. Because Jesus is your source of life. He's the one who passes nutrients through to you. He's the one that gives you your strength. So stick to him like glue. John's got those words of Jesus in his mind as he says to these Christians, now, little children, abide in him. It's what John wants for his readers. And that's what, if he were here, he would want for us too. Cling on to him. That's what he's saying. Now, he then gives us three reasons to remain in him, three reasons to abide in him. And all of them, I've got words that begin with the letter B for you tonight, and you can thank me afterwards for that. No, I don't usually manage that, but to be fair, I have stretched it a little bit, you will notice. Here's the first one. The first reason to abide in him, verse 28, because we can be bold when he returns. So boldness, it gives us boldness. So verse 28, he says, abide in him. And then he says, when he appears. And you'll notice he's definitely got this thought in his mind because he talks about it again in verse 2. Chapter 3, verse 2, he says, when he is revealed. So when he appears and when he is revealed. And the word he's using here is the word parousia. The word parousia means a physical presence, an appearing, a presence. So I could say to you, I could use this word to say, well, I had a parousia tonight, and all I really mean is, I appeared, I turned up here at church, and you can all see me. We see it's got a different meaning when it's talking about Jesus, but it's the same, that's the same word. It just means about someone appearing. Do you know, our world laughs at this concept. If we were to sort of rank the Christian beliefs that make people scoff, the second coming, I think, would be right up near the top. The thought of Jesus coming, it seems absurd to people. I think it's much more absurd to believe that human life, with all its emotional and physical complexities, to believe that it can spawn from a bunch of atoms, that those bunches of atoms can spawn from literally nothing. I think that's much more crazy than believing that a God created this world and is then going to come back at some point. John says this with no sort of sense of, well, yeah, people may scoff, they may laugh, but it makes sense. There will be a return of Jesus Christ. And I've got a question for the children. In verse 28, I hope some of you children have got your Bibles there in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 28. John says that there's a feeling there that we could have, a feeling that we can have, a response that some people will have in verse 28 when Jesus comes again. I'm wondering if any children can tell me, how will some people be able to feel when Jesus comes again? What will some people have? So verse 28, I'll help you with this. When he appears, we may have... I can see there are some who don't. Go on, Max.
Confidence.
We may have confidence. Thank you. Just think about that day and what's going to happen. The Son of God, in all his glory, bursts through the skies, and it happens suddenly. You're at your work and you're on the phone to someone. You're catching up with your paperwork. You're doing something really mundane, because people will be doing mundane things when the Son of God comes again. You're trying to get a printer working on your hands and knees, something like that. You know, Jesus talks about people grinding at the mill, that sort of thing. People are talking about what they saw on TV last night, and there'll be no warning. So think about what the world will be like that day. There will be packs of chicken breasts in fridges. because people were planning to cook a chicken curry that night, and it won't happen. There will be essays that never get finished. Don't take that as a reason not to finish your essays, okay? That's not where we're going with this. That's not the application here. There will be exams that people have studied for that they never actually then get to sit. There will be a suddenness. Things will be curtailed. It won't just sort of get to a point where everything's finished naturally anyway. It will be sudden. And John says there's two sort of responses we can have. The first one is some people will be confident. Isn't that amazing? An incredible thing is happening and you're confident. You're bold. Why is that? Well, have you ever been in your house and you thought you were alone and then you hear a noise? I bet that's happened. It's probably happened to most of us at some point or other. You thought it was just you and you creep upstairs or you creep over to the kitchen. So you thought you were all by yourself and you peer around the room and you say, oh, it's Dad. Oh, it's my brother or my sister. I said, I thought you'd gone out. And they say, no, I did. And I did, but I popped back in. And I was terrified. Why aren't you scared when you see them? Well, because it's someone you know, and it's someone you trust. You know you're not in danger, because, it's Dad. I'm not scared of Dad, am I? Jesus' coming will be surprising and new. It'll be something you've never experienced before. But if you know him, you can be bold. You can be confident, because he's coming as your friend, as your saviour. So you've got nothing to fear. And John says it will happen if you abide in him, if you keep on feeding on him, if you keep on clinging on to him, looking to him for your nutrients, for your life, for your strength. Keep on doing that, and then you'll have nothing to fear. But notice he says we may have confidence and not be ashamed. So the implication of that is there will be some people who will be ashamed on that day. I think you've probably got these false teachers in mind here. I think there's probably a particular shame that comes with hearing the gospel, hearing the truth, and then not responding to it, pushing it away. I think for us, we're not just talking here about every unbeliever in the world. And there's a particular shame about people who went to church all throughout their childhood, heard the gospel again and again. People who heard the truth and thought, no, I know best. I don't need this stuff. Or people who think, well, yeah, it might be true. So I'll do some Christian stuff. I don't mind a bit of churchy type living. I'll do some of that, but I'll hedge my bets because who really knows anyway? People who hear the truth, imagine the shock of having heard it all again and again. Imagine the horror as your stomach turns. John uses the word being ashamed. You ever had that moment of sudden realization? You suddenly put your hand to your pocket. I left my phone on the park bench. That sort of lurch in your stomach. You put your hand in your pocket. My wallet. Where's my wallet gone? And you start suddenly panicking, thinking about all the stuff that's in it. And then you find it on the dining table or somewhere or other. But it's that moment of utter panic. The shame. I heard and I knew and I didn't respond. And that's why the choice is simple for us. Of all people, we're here. We have no excuse. You have no excuse. So you need to come to Jesus today and trust him. Right, second reason to abide in him is because we have been born by him. We have been born. There's a new birth. And that's verse 29 and chapter 3, verse 1. Remember, John is teaching and applying what Jesus taught him. And this time, I think he's thinking of something different in the Gospel of John. This time, I think he's thinking back to John chapter 3 and that conversation with Nicodemus, where Jesus says, unless someone's born again, they won't see the kingdom of God. Jesus describes there how you receive a new identity, a new life, a new family. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, what manner of love is this? What manner of love the Father has bestowed on us? Now, when it says manner there, the word manner there is the same word used when Jesus calmed the storm and the disciples say, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? It's the same word as when they say, who is this? What they literally say is, what manner of person is it? What type of person could possibly be like this? In fact, what they're really saying is, what country does he come from? This person, this man, he's otherworldly. And now John's saying, what type of love is this? This is an out of this world sort of love that God has shown to us. I like how the NIV translates this verse. They say this, how great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. A dictionary definition of the word lavish. Here it is, to bestow something in generous or extravagant quantities. I bet there's probably some of that going on this week with pancakes. I bet some of you didn't just have a little bit of lemon juice and sugar. I bet there were strawberries and blueberries and cherries and all sorts of other stuff. Chocolate buttons, squirty cream and ice cream, and you piled it on higher and higher. What we'd say is you were lavishly decorating your pancake. Extravagance, over the top generosity. God lavishes his love on us. And then the NIV includes a phrase that the New King James translators miss out. But I think it should be in there. And it's a phrase that I love this phrase, the simplicity of it. The NIV carries on and says, and that is what we are. So the NIV says, how great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. And that's what we are. See, this would be a wonderful truth if it applied to other people, wouldn't it? You know, God's mercy to anyone would be great. But with John, and John's been a Christian, we think, when he writes this book, about 60 odd years. And yet, I hope you can see the personal excitement there for him. He's got this sort of, almost like this wobble in his, and it applies to me. I'm a child of God too. John carries on, he says that the world does not know us. And he says that the reason it doesn't know us is because it didn't know Jesus. And why not? Why didn't so many people recognize him? There's various things we could talk about, but I think one of them is Jesus came and his glory was contained within a frail human body. He lived a life of humility, a life of obedience, a life of sacrifice. He didn't have the sort of conventional appearance and status of what you'd think a king would look like. And so only a few people see him for who he really is. And John says, it's going to be the same for you too. The world won't see you as the privileged people that you are. The world won't look at the people in this room tonight and think, what special people. What privileged individuals. And yet we are. That's what John's saying, and that is what we are. So, how do you know you're born again? If you go back to verse 29, John says, everyone who practices righteousness is born of him. How can you be confident? These blessings are yours. How can you be confident? You can say, and that's what I am, a child of God with God's love lavished upon me. Everyone who practices righteousness is born of him. Back in 1968, Huntington, California, there was a sect called the Children of God. Was started. Some famous people went. Apparently the guitarist of Fleetwood Mac left the band to join this Children of God sect. They're still going now, apparently, although they're much smaller than they were. Now, were they actually Children of God? That's the name they claim for themselves? Well, after a little while, the FBI started investigating them for serious allegations of child abuse and slavery and keeping people in solitary confinement and so on. Were they children of God? Well, John's answer would be quite simple. No, they didn't practice righteousness. There's something inconsistent about them. But when our lives change, because we've been born again, it's evidence that we have been born again. Then the third reason Jesus gives, John gives for us to abide in him, is because we are becoming like him. There's the B where I'm stretching a little bit. We are becoming like him. And that's verse 2. What does it mean to be a child of God? I'm sure children have had these times before. When people say to you, you look just like your dad. You're the spitting image of your mum. You've got the same laugh, you've got the same eyes. And you feel a bit embarrassed and you think, oh, I wish I didn't. You know, you don't always like that. To be a child of God means you share the family likeness. It means people should be able to look at you and say, you're like your father. The things you love, they're the same as the things he loves. The things that thrill you are the things that thrill God. And you have the same interests as him. And the things that upset you and grieve you are the things that upset and grieve God as well. Ever been to one of those parties where everyone's been asked to bring a baby photo? And you can go around the room. And what you can often do is you can look at the photo and then you can look at the person on the ground and you can think, oh yeah, I see that now. Do you know what you can't do? Is you can't look at a baby and work out what they're going to look like when they're grown up. You can't do it that way round, can you? You can only do it when the person's actually grown up. You can only look back and think, oh yeah, I see the same eyes now, actually. You can get these apps on your phone, can't you, where, not that I've done this, but you can do this thing where people, you can make yourself look 30 years or so older. And why anyone would want to do that, I don't know. But apparently you can. Now John's saying, here's what you look like right now. You're children of God. But then he says in verse 2, so now we're children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. There are some things that we don't know. We can't sort of say, well, that's what we're going to look like in the future. That's what we'll be then. But then he does tell us something very important. There's something we don't know. It's not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, here's something we do know, we shall be like him. So we're going to picture a child who every year as they grow up looks a bit more like her mum. And then she becomes an adult and daughter and mum go shopping together. And you can barely tell them apart. And all the sales assistants ask them if they're sisters. And the mum is complimented and the daughter's not quite so happy about it. Yeah, you're imagining a dad and a son playing together on a rugby team. And you sort of do a double take because they're just so similar in so many ways. He says, we will be like him. That's what John says. There's things we don't know about this. But don't forget the stuff you do know. You will be like him. What does that mean? Well, Jesus has a resurrection body now. A body that is glorious and powerful and undefeatable. A body that in some ways is like ours, but in some ways is so different. Jesus has a purity about him that we don't have now, but we will do. We'll be free from sin one day. And we'll know that, and we'll see him. He says, we shall see him as he is. I hope you're looking forward to the day when you'll be able to see him, and then you'll be able to look at yourself, and you'll be able to shout with amazement, I'm just like him now. Just like him. Because that's the future you have if you're one of God's children. So three reasons to abide that we can then have boldness when he returns. Because we're born of God and because we're becoming like him. And now there's a therefore, a sort of conclusion that John gives us, and it's got a be in it as well. Therefore, we must behave like him now. Therefore, we must behave like him. And that's verse 3. Now let me just, so verse 3. Everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself, just as he is pure. If Jesus is pure, well, I can't just say to myself, well, I'll wait until heaven because I know I'll be pure then. No, we purify ourselves now because we have this hope in us. Now, let me ask you a question. When is righteous living hardest for you? When is it? What are the circumstances in your life when you find living for Christ the most difficult? When is it that, so look back at verse 29, it talks there about practicing righteousness. When is it that you find practicing righteousness the most difficult? I'm not talking about times of day or night. You might start thinking about particular times or particular places or particular people you're with. We probably start thinking in that way. I want to tell you what I think it is. It's the times in your life when the wow factor of John 3 verse 1 is a bit of a distant memory. The times when being a child of God and all its privileges just don't seem that thrilling all of a sudden. And it doesn't make your heart leap so much. We said with John, 60 years after he started to follow Jesus, he still got the, I can't believe this is true of me. I'm so amazed. I'm a child of God. It's that sort of that thrill of excitement, like when you meet that special someone and you find out, she likes me too. Or that moment when you get down on one knee and you propose and she says yes, and you think, I'm going to spend my life with it. Wow, this is amazing. Or the moment you open your envelope and you think, I passed. I can't believe I passed that exam. Or the excitement when you get that phone call and say, we'd like to offer you the job. You think, yes, I got the job. John's writing the way he is here because he's still so excited, 60 years on. So the question for us is, have we lost sight of what an amazing, thrilling thing it is that God's love has been lavishly heaped upon us, that he's made us his children, that he's making us more and more like him every day, and that one day we will be like him, and we'll see him, and we'll look just like him? He says in verse 3, everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself. When we've got that hope as our focal point, it's what drives us on to greater purity. Righteousness, John says, is the evidence of abiding in him. So let's say this just to close. What do you do when the temptation feels so great? When there's a part of you that just wants to throw in the towel? When you think, what am I going to do? How do I keep going with this? John says, abide in him. Keep reminding yourself of your great need of Christ. Keep reminding yourself of what you were when you were detached from him, when you weren't a branch on that vine. Keep on stirring up for yourself, in yourself, a love of Jesus Christ. And abiding in him means saying to yourself, I need to draw all my spiritual life and energy from him. So if you want to take a verse into this week, a verse to just have flowing around your mind, a verse that John says will spur us on to purity and righteousness, a verse that when you feel those temptations and challenges you can quote to yourself, and give you nothing better than 1 John 3, verse 1. How great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. That's what we are. Nothing less than that. So keep on going, John says. Keep on abiding in him. Because one day we will be like him. One day we will see him. We're going to